I'll be reading from Genesis 2. Then the Lord God formed a man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome, everyone. Visitors, we're especially glad you're with us. I want to invite you to be back. We've got several out today. Hope everybody's okay. I know just a lot going on, but we want to remember that tonight is the fifth Sunday singing. So we'll meet here at 6 o'clock and sing with our sister congregations, and then we'll have a fellowship meal that follows that. So come and enjoy singing and fellowshipping with some other brethren in our area. So I hope that you will be back for that tonight. Retreat is not this next weekend, but the next one, the 7th, 8th, and 9th. Please see Dan, if you haven't, about going on the retreat. We need to get a count so we'll know how much food to have. There'll be an abundance, but we want to make sure we're prepared for everybody that's coming. And you certainly are welcome to bring friends and guests to go along with that. It's a great place for families. We'll have lots of young people, so it's for young and older alike. So hope that you plan on coming to the retreat 7th, 8th, and 9th. So see Dan, if you would, if you haven't, and let him know that you're planning on coming. If you plan on bringing some folks, let Dan know. All right, we're going to continue in Acts 17 this morning. And we'll kind of read this. Let me set a little bit of the stage for this. Again, we've talked about it over the last few weeks. Paul is in Athens. The Athenians are all about learning and discussing new ideas and new thoughts. And Athens is a center of knowledge and of ideas. And in fact, I was either reading something or listening to someone. I think I was listening to something the other day that says the United States really owes our foundation, our constitution, our government to three great cities. It would be Athens, Rome, and Jerusalem. So Athens has had a tremendous impact on the world at the time, and certainly on our thought, because the Athenians were involved in their government. And one of the great things that the Greeks did was spread a common language across the world at their time. And then Rome followed up with common travel. But so Athens was a great city of its time and has had a great impact even into our day. And so Paul is here in Athens. And so the approach here is different. The conversation here is different than what we've seen when he's been in the synagogues, because these Greeks are going to have a different background than the individuals in the synagogues, because individuals in the synagogues are going to be Jews or proselytes, right? What's a proselyte? It's not something that you try to exterminate. It's not something that you drink after a hard day of exercise. What's a proselyte? It's someone who was not born into something, but converts. So when we talk about proselytes into Judaism, it's somebody who's not born into the Jewish religion, but someone who is converted into the Jewish religion. But for the Jews and for those who had been proselyted or proselytized, or I'm not sure what's the proper word?
Proselytized.
There you go. I came up with that. Sounds like something we studied about prehistoric times, wasn't it? But proselytized into the Jewish faith, they're going to understand the Old Testament, right? So what does Paul do when he speaks to them? He starts with the teachings of the Old Testament and says, this Jesus of Nazareth who died in Jerusalem is the fulfillment of the prophecy and the pattern and the flow, if you will, from the Old Testament. That Jesus is this promise that really is made to Abraham that we've been studying in our classes. that this blessing of all nations, it's Jesus. And that I'm going to make many kings out of your descendants is true, but Jesus is the great king, right? And so he talks to them about that. But to these Greeks, they're not familiar with the Old Testament. In fact, how are they worshiping in Athens? What's their, it's interesting, the phraseology in the King James Version, and I don't dislike that, but when we memorized these years ago in the King James, Paul looks and talks to the Ephesians, he says, I see that you are very, what's the word he uses? You remember? Today, it's translated religious. You are very religious. What was it translated in 1611 in the KJV? I see that you are, come on now, some of you are gray-haired like I am. You read it in the King James Version. You are very superstitious. I see that you are very superstitious. I believe that's the KJV translation. You might want to look at that. I see that you are very superstitious or very religious. They were very religious or superstitious people, but they worshipped all kind of gods, right? But they don't know Jehovah. They don't know Jehovah, Yahweh, the God who is the Creator, the Lord of Lords and the King of Kings. And so, how do they worship God? Jehovah. Big G. You remember? They have an inscription to the unknown God. They've got a monument, a memorial, a temple. There's temples all over Athens. We've talked about that. I mean, we're familiar with the Parthenon, right? We talked about that a couple weeks ago. But do you know, on top of the Acropolis, which is just the hill outside of Athens, the Acropolis, it just sounds good, rather than big hill, but for the Alabama fans, the big hill outside of Athens, Greece, not Alabama, okay? I'm just clarifying everything here, is the Parthenon. But there's another temple up there. It's called the Temple Erectus. It is to Poseidon. There are actually two on the Acropolis. And there's a temple to Zeus. It's down here. I mean, so it's not like they got one big temple. They got temples and monuments everywhere. That's why Paul makes that statement. I see you're very religious, or you're very superstitious, or you're very into the gods. And he says, you even have one to an unknown God, or to the unknown God. So the Greeks didn't want to leave anybody out, right? Won't leave anybody out. Because why? Well, one, they just, I guess, want to be complete. But what's the other reason? You don't want to make the gods mad. That is man's need in ancient times, to not anger the gods. When something bad happens, why did it happen? The gods are angry with us, right? So what do? We offer sacrifice. We build temples. We wait on these statues of the gods. So why? Because we love them? No. We just want to satisfy them. We just don't want them to curse us, and maybe they'll bless us. Okay? Does that make sense? Maybe they'll bless us. And so Paul says, I want to declare to you this unknown God. Now I want to back up a minute. It says that Paul is meeting with the Areopagus. The Areopagus, translated Mars Hill. So you might know this as Paul's sermon on Mars Hill. There's a Bible college in Florence, Alabama, called Mars Hill. Mars Hill, named after this place. But what most scholars think today is, and I've been to Mars Hill on a couple of occasions, and it's part way up the Acropolis. All right, so you can look up and see the temples on top of the Acropolis, and you can look down and see the temple to Zeus is right below you, and the temples and the Stoa, which is the mall, all around. So from this place you can see. But there is a council, like a leading council, that used to meet at the Areopagus and took that name. So whether or not Paul is actually on that place on that day, we know he's at least speaking to this leadership group that has taken the name Areopagus, because that's where they used to meet. So when you read that, he may have been on that place, which would be neat, because it's certainly like Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. If he were there, they would have certainly been there before. But if they were there, I mean, you're able to visualize everything that Paul is telling you. But we know he's speaking to this group, this leadership group in Athens that have taken their name from this rock outcropping on the way up the Acropolis, the Areopagus or Mars Hill. Okay? I feel like I'm talking about the Battle of Gettysburg. Little Round Top and Big Round Top and all of that. If you don't get all that, it's okay. But I just want you to know as you read it, you know, what these things mean. Because I think it's important for us to understand what they mean and where they are. So it's this ruling group that's just taking its name from this place. So Paul is going to speak to them. But now their background is going to be polytheistic. Means the study of many gods. Monotheistic is one God, right? Mono. Not mononucleosis, but mono, one, poly, many. All right, no secrets here, so we know. So they're from a polytheistic world, but they've got this God, this worship to the unknown God, and Paul says, that's the God that I'm going to declare to you. And he starts with this. He doesn't talk about Abraham at this point, because they don't know who Abraham is. Oh, they might a little bit from people that have traveled because they're into learning, right? But Abraham would be no different to them than Gulliver. For those of you who remember Gulliver's Travels, right? Or some other character that we might have studied in literature. But here's how he starts. He says, this unknown God is the creator of heaven and earth. And Paul read for us about God creating man, and we've been studying from Genesis, and you know I'm wild about Genesis, because I think if we miss Genesis, we miss so much. Because what he's saying to them is, this unknown God, this God that you don't know, is actually the God who created everything. The heavens and the earth. He created everything. And he created us, mankind, in his image. And so he does not bear the image of gold and silver. It's not an image that we've made, because what do they got? Not only do they have the Parthenon, but there's this huge figure of Athena in the Parthenon. And he says, this God who created us, and created the heavens and the earth, and created everything, because their gods were gods of something, right? The god of this, the god of that. There's a god of fertility, there's a god of the seas, there's a god of harvest, you know, god of the sun. I don't know what all they were. I forget if I ever knew. All right? But he's saying, this is the God who created the heavens and earth, and he's over everything. And he does not dwell in temples made with human hands. He can't be contained in a temple. Even one as glorious as the Parthenon. He's not contained in temples. And he does not need us to feed and clothe him. Virgin girls, I think, took a year rotation. It was an honor for a year to serve at the temple of Athena and to sew her clothes and to parade to the temple, I think on a daily basis, and bring food and clothing to Athena. So this is something they're going to, I mean, it makes it make even more sense what he says, right? But God who created the heavens and earth created us. In him, we live and move and have our very existence. And so he doesn't need the food and clothing that we provide, Because it's in Him that we survive. See the difference? See how He's talking to them, balancing against what they know? Balancing against what they know. And He says, I'll even quote your poets, your literature, your entertainment. As your own poets have said, we are His offspring. This is not an uncommon thought for you learned people. Even your own poets have said, we are His offspring. And that is true. That is true. Let's read it. Paul then stood at the meeting of the Areopagus and said, men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. So you are ignorant of the very thing you worship. So we're worshiping this unknown God, right? But you don't know who He is. And this is what I am going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by human hands. And He is not served by human hands as if He needed anything. Rather, He Himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. What else do we get from this unknown God? Everything. That doesn't necessarily stand out to you, to me, but it would to them because they're worshiping gods all over because each god has a different purpose, place, opportunity, right? He said, I'm declaring to the God that's in charge of everything. Everything. From one man, the creation story. From one man He made all the nations that they should inhabit the whole earth. And He marked out their appointed times in which they would live and the boundaries of their habitation. I kind of ad-libbed that. I didn't ad-lib, but I just quoted it from a different version. God did this so that they would seek Him and perhaps reach out for Him and find Him, though He is not far from any one of us. This God that you don't know is not far. For in Him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are His offspring. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by human design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance. Whoa. Now, that would have struck them a little bit, wouldn't it? I mean, that's a word we don't even really like too good. Ignorant, right? Ignorant. He says, and if you're a learned person, you really aren't going to like... I mean, He didn't say they were ignorant, but He says their view is one of ignorance, right? Now, that's not going to settle well with them. Understand that. Understand the audience, right? If you call me ignorant, I'm probably not taking real great offense to it. I ain't going to like it, let me be honest with you. But I get it. But if I pride myself on my learning and my degrees and, you know, my ability to hold my own with you on any intellectual endeavor and you say my views are ignorant, I'm going to take, you know, that's going to make me set up. But now He, and God in the past, overlooked this ignorance of worshiping other gods and not knowing who He was. But now He commands all people everywhere to repent. For He has set a day when He would judge the world with justice by the man He has appointed. He has given proof of this to everyone by raising Him from the dead. We're going to stop right there because we're not going to get through all this today, which is all right. I told you we'd spend some time in Acts 17. I want to talk about something here that I think is important. It's a little bit of an aside, but it's important. Why is evolution and the study and teaching of an evolution such a huge thing in our culture, in our world? Why is that such a huge thing? Why do people hold so dearly to that, and why are some of us so opposed to that? I would fall into the latter category. Let me, full disclosure. Why? Because it's not about just the origin of man. It is about God. It's about God. Now, let's be clear. We need to just talk about things and for our young people. If you read the scripture, God creates each kind, right? And in the ark, God puts one of each kind. That doesn't mean... We'll talk about instrumental music next week in our worship, all right? No, we won't. It doesn't mean that every breed of cow God made at the beginning or put on the ark. Every breed of cat or dog, right? But they're kind. And so we understand that there is an adaptation and changes within species, right? I think we all, I mean, you can witness that. We, even any of us who are in agriculture, see that. By selection, things change. We see it in the Bible story. What about Joseph? About Jacob, remember? The striped sheep and the spotted sheep and those things. Now, it doesn't change other than miraculously by stripping rods of wood and that type of thing that they see when they're mating. That's a totally different deal. But God used that. But we select for that, right? We know what genes are dominant, what genes are recessive, and we select for those, for animals that perform. We select for those. You know, Mac Allen's got a bunch of buckskin and Palomino horses that he selects for because there's a demand for those, right? And so, it's not true only in animal agriculture. Man, we got more numbers now than you can shake a stick at. We got indexes for weaning and for maternal and predictions of weaning weights and how much growth a bull's daughters will give based on milk production. We can know those now, and we genomically test them, so we've improved our accuracies. So we know. You know, used to, you just went and they look good. And now we kind of know with some significance how they're going to perform, Brian. We get that, don't we? But the same thing's true in plant agriculture. I don't know what your yields were this time, Ernie, but they're a whole lot different than they were 30 years ago, aren't they, buddy? Part of that is the technique is better, but the genetics of the plant's better. I've shared this with you before, but corn stalks used to have one ear on them. One ear on a corn stalk, that was it. And one of the first hybrids that had more than one ear was called Neil's Paymaster and created by Mr. Neil in Wilson County. For those of you who know Margaret Thompson, Dr. Roy Thompson's wife, was her grandfather that developed Neil's Paymaster that doubled production. So we know things change. It's not a denial that things change. But the origin, where they came from, is from God. And that has been extrapolated back to this all just merged that we've all just come from this same primordial slime. That's fun to say, isn't it? But that's not the biblical story. But I'm going to tell you what is interesting to me. If you look what those who would promote a godless creation, their timeline reflects very much what Moses tells us in the Genesis, doesn't it? Which came first. Isn't that interesting? Have you ever looked back at that? God said, this is the order in which I did it. But that God did it. That God did it. And so, this push is the same in the garden with Adam and Eve. Why did they eat the fruit? I heard somebody say this week, I can't remember what that was, that the problem in the garden was not the apple on the tree, it was the pear on the ground. Think about that. But what was the desire? What did Satan say to them? If you eat of this, you'll do what? You'll be like God. You'll know the difference between good and evil. You'll get to make the rules. That's really what he's saying. You get to make the rules. You get to decide. And God doesn't want that for you. Well, the whole evolutionary thought, one is to erase God, the Creator, whom is exactly who Paul is explaining to these learned people of Athens, right? That the God who is true and real that I want to tell you about is the Creator God. Not only does it remove God, but it elevates man to this position of the highest order on the food chain, for lack of anything else, and so we get to decide. And those are all things that Satan does, right? Do not think that this does not have spiritual implications. If you think that there's nothing spiritual about this, you have really put blinders on. I don't want to be ugly, but you put blinders on. This is a spiritual battle to remove God from our hearts and from our lives. Because there's something in us that knows that there is more than just us. Interesting thought. How many of you have said, "My, how fast time passes"? Now, some of you who are really little have not. But for most of us, whoo, how fast it's passed. Except for Red, who celebrated his 17th anniversary. He said, "Whoo, that hadn't been all that quick." But no, that was a whole different... He didn't say that. He didn't say... But how... And yeah, sorry, brother. Or how fast somebody has grown. We see a child, and if we haven't seen them for just a little while, how much they've grown. And we're constantly shocked by how much change has occurred through time and how fast time passes. One of our theologians, and I'm sorry, I can't remember who it is to give them credit for it, says that our being surprised at the passing of time is like a fish constantly being shocked by the wetness of water. And the only way that it makes sense is if that fish were destined one day not to be in the water. Or that we one day are destined not to be controlled by time. It's an interesting thought, isn't it? Interesting thought that we are destined for eternity. That there is more than this life bound by time. More than this life where we pass through, we're born, we live, and we die. And that's the end of it. Because I'm going to tell you, if evolution is the fact, that's it. You live, you're born, you live, and you die. And as the Lion King song would say, you complete the circle of life, right? That's it. Although that has a spiritual implication to it, doesn't it? Mufasa is not gone. But I'm going to tell you, the evolutionary message is, you're gone. But there's something in us that knows. There was something in the Athenians who did not know Jehovah, but they worshiped the gods because they knew there was something beyond them. Right? There was something beyond them. There was something greater. Eternity is in our hearts. We know there is something beyond this. And Paul is saying this God, whom created the heavens and the earth, created us in His image. And we are not the highest order of an evolutionary process, but we are a created being made in the very image of the Creator Himself. We are not sophisticated animals. We're not sophisticated animals. So let's don't act like it. We are creations made in the image of the Creator God with responsibilities, not only for our own lives, but to increase and to care for and to rule over the creation. So all of this discussion tries to remove God. It's just Satan trying to remove God. Satan's saying, guys, you be in control. You decide what's right. Decide what's wrong. documentary on television about polar bears and seals or sea lions, one or the other. I'm not sure. And so, guess what the polar bear is trying to do? It's walruses. It was walruses. Guess what the polar bear is trying to do? Walruses are having little ones. I don't know what that's called. I know it's giving birth, but I don't know what little, you know, foaling, calving, I don't know. I don't know what little walruses are called. Walleye. That's a whole different thing. But anyway, they're giving birth. And so what's the polar bear want to do? Eat them. Because he needs the nutrition. She needs the nutrition. And so there is a little walrus, and the polar bear goes after it, and the big walruses with their tusks and all attack the polar bear and actually run the polar bear off. They run the polar bear off. And the narrator says the polar bear will never make it back because the ice is thinning as a result of global warming. And the thought of that is, as human beings, we should do something about the global warming. I'm going to get into that argument with you. But that's the inference that by the decisions we've made, we don't say. But there's nothing that says that the polar bear is a murderous, ravaging child killer. Why? Because we realize there's a difference between human beings and animals. As much as we want to talk about evolution, there's something in us that knows that we're created differently. And that we have responsibilities and capabilities above the animals. We inherently know it. We will argue as humanists against it, but yet we inherently know it. We inherently know that we have greater responsibilities and greater controls and greater opportunities. Paul goes to these learned people and says, there is one true God, and He created everything. He created everything, and He created us in His image. We didn't create God. We didn't decide what God looks like. And so we made something out of something very precious, out of gold or silver, which are precious metals, right? Were then, even are today. But God created us in His image, not the other way around. And in Him, we have our existence. It is God who has created us, given us life, who tells us where we're going to live, when we're going to live, how we're going to live, and provides us all the things that we need to live. We don't provide for God's needs. God provides for our needs. That's what Paul's saying to them. And the same thing is true. The true and living God, every good and perfect gift comes from God, right? Athenians, with all your accomplishments. Americans, with all your accomplishments. And we have many, do we not? Hey, we do. We do, man. I'm not ashamed of that. I'm not ashamed of that at all. I mean, we have made accomplishments in space travel, in communication, in medicine. I mean, we've just, architecture. We've made all kinds of accomplishments. But at the end of the day, it is not us who takes care of us. It is not us who makes sure God is comfortable and have all He needs. It is the Creator God, the true and living God, who provides for all of our needs. In Him we live and move and have our existence. But we're His offspring. We're the children of God. Because for them, they understood that the children of the gods were a more powerful, special people, right? Yeah. We're children of God. We're going to talk about this some more next week, but there's so much here. There's so much here. And so much that even goes on in our world today. But the fact is, It is God who created us. It is God who provides for us. It is God who blesses us. And it is God who sacrificed Himself and His Son. It was not our serving Him that just appeases God. It is God, out of love, really beyond what we can imagine, who gave His Son in mercy and grace that you and I might be forgiven, that we might be children of God, and that we might be heirs of life eternal. If you need to respond, do that while we stand and sing.